From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Governor Bruce Rauner defends how his administration's handled the outbreaks, even as residents have continued to get sick. And now a commission studying what to do about it has drafted a list of recommendations to address the plumbing and outdated facilities. The commission's estimated price tag for a new facility, $250 million, plus plumbing upgrades.
Speaking of radio, we're hearing from Chinese radio that the country plans reciprocal tariffs on 106 U.S. products.
Agricultural is obviously a very key one. That's seen as really hitting Donald Trump's base, his voting base in the U.S.
China plans 25% tariff on U.S. soybeans is what we're getting.
And wow, that's
sort of
the nuclear.
See the market reaction.
That really is the nuclear option.
I think it just happened so quickly that no one has been able to calculate yet exactly what's going to happen. It's going to be a negative effect. We just don't know the scope of that yet.
The vast majority of states with a state income tax have a progressive income tax. We're the ones who haven't moved for too many years. Since 1970, when it was put in the Constitution, you know, we've been stuck with this constitutional provision for a flat tax while all the other states have advanced.
That is J.B. Pritzker, candidate for governor, reiterating his call for a graduated income tax. And he says before that, Illinois might need to raise its existing flat tax rate. Meanwhile, President Trump's trade war with China is hitting Illinois farmers, with Beijing imposing tariffs on two of our biggest agricultural products, soy and pork. We also heard in the top there from Larry O'Brien of the Illinois Pork Producers Association. We'll talk about that and more this week on State Week. I'm Brian Mackey. Sean Crawford is away. With me in studio at NPR Illinois is Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, and a longtime Statehouse reporter and observer, and my colleague Daisy Contreras, who covers the Statehouse for NPR Illinois. Joining us by phone from Chicago is Rick Pearson, political reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Rick, good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
So, Rick, let's start with you. You wrote this week about J.B. Pritzker. He held a news conference to talk about education matters in Illinois and talked about what he wants to see with tax rates.
Yeah, well, he talked about tax rates, but he didn't give any, and that's kind of the problem. It's kind of a trick bag of his own making here, where we had basically all of the Democratic candidates for governor came out in support of a progressive income tax. Very few of them even discussed what rates they would apply to income in Illinois. So Pritzker has never said what he believes those progressive scale of rates should be, and still won't say. But in the meantime, he concludes that because of the need to have a constitutional amendment to have a true graduated income tax, because the Constitution mandates a flat income tax, to get a constitutional amendment passed could take what he says is at least 2 years. And in the meantime, he would propose raising the current 4.95% personal income tax rate even higher, coupled with raising deductions and create what he calls an artificial graduated tax.
Yeah, sort of a jerry-rig thing where you'd have you could sort of, it's, even though it wouldn't be written into the Constitution, you could give people money back who are on the, what did he say, in the middle class or trying to get into the middle class, I think was the turn of phrase I heard him use.
Right, but when you look at the things that he's talking about, particularly with education funding, boosting education funding, but also wanting to provide property tax relief, and then you're going to talk about deductions that would take away revenue. It would seem to be that this would require a sizable increase in the state income tax. Granted, there would be additional deductions, but again, he won't say. And, you know, we're on the one-year point of the Pritzker campaign. He's now the Democratic nominee. And I think it's going to be one of these repeated situations where he's going to say tax rates need to jump, and reporters are going to consistently say, how high?
Right. And Charlie, I mean, he's asking the voters here to elect him on a raise taxes platform, which is not unheard of in Illinois. Pat Quinn ran on that 4 years ago, but it's not exactly what you expect the typical politician to run on. Are you? What do you think about his decision not to give rates here? Is that a shrewd political move, or is it something that's going to continue haunting him?
Well, I think it would be better off for him were he to actually discuss some idea of what the range could be. He could look at one of our neighboring states and say, for example, here's what they do in Wisconsin. And so we would adapt their rates. But he's right. It would take probably 2 years or more because you have to amend the Constitution. It's very unlikely that an amendment will be put before the voters this fall. So that means you're looking at 2020. The deadline for getting amendments on the ballot this November is the first week in May. And I just don't see any action to try and do that. And the rates are important because people need to know. You could structure them however. You could structure them so that everybody gets a tax break except people making $1 million or more. Or you could structure it so that everybody pays a little bit more. And that's where the uncertainty is, and I think that's an issue that he has to address. He has to propose, here is how I would use it. And as I say, there are models out there. All of our neighboring states have graduated income tax rates with the exception of Indiana. And so it wouldn't make us an outlier to have something like that. But I think you do have to do it by constitutional amendment, and I think this notion of increasing deductions or increasing exemptions based on one's income level and try and do a backdoor graduated income tax will be challenged in court, and it could very well be thrown out.
Although we did, I mean, and Charlie, you've pointed out that, you know, the voters did approve a millionaire's tax on the last general election where there were gubernatorial candidates on the ballot back in 2014, although the legislature never did anything with that. Rick, I mean, what do you think? Is this one of those condemned if you do, condemned if you don't things where if he puts the rates out there? Yeah.
Yeah, that's the trick bag that he's created. But and I kind of agree with Charlie. I think people would like to kind of know where is the rate where you're neutral, where you're not paying any more, you're paying less. What is the income level? And I think that's an important aspect to looking at this whole question is, you know, can you design a plan where, you know, the impact is felt more heavily among higher incomes, but what does J.B. Pritzker, a billionaire heir to the Hyatt Hotel fortune, what does he consider to be, you know, a major income? What does he consider to be middle class income?
Well, that's why I would say I would look at the rates in our neighboring states, and I don't happen to have it with me now, but I've downloaded what the rates are everywhere, and some of them start out where you have to pay an income tax at the $20,000 income level. Some of them don't have their income tax kick in until higher. Some of them go up almost to 10% for the very top earners. And the way it works, it's not that a millionaire would have to pay a higher rate on all the income. It's on income levels, like the federal income tax. For the first, say, $20,000, nobody pays. For the next, maybe $50,000, everybody pays the same rate. When you get up over your whatever income you have in excess of $1 million, maybe you pay 10%. You know, that's how it would work. And the models are out there. So it strikes me that he should decide what he wants to do and say, well, here's how they do it in Missouri, or here's how they do it in Iowa, or here's exactly what's in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and then, you know, and while we're on the topic of money, Charlie, you know, Pritzker, it's interesting to note too that Pritzker gave his campaign another $7 million, bringing him up to $76.5 million just for his campaign. So, you know, it's interesting. We have two millionaires, two very wealthy men, going against each other, and then they're talking tax increases.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, Daisy, because, you know, Pritzker, and Rick, I wonder what you think about this. He's kind of an imperfect messenger in a lot of ways. Not only is he a billionaire, which I guess that's right, a billionaire coming in saying, I'm willing to pay more. That's not maybe what you expect to hear from super wealthy people. On the other hand, here's a guy who has money offshore that he, you know, for that he benefits from for tax reasons. Famously, there was the story last year about him taking the toilets out of a property that he owns next door to his main residence in order to lower the tax burden. This sort of muddies the message a little bit, right?
It absolutely does. And in fact, it's been kind of a an early refrain from Bruce Rauner's campaign, referring to Pritzker as, in their words, a tax cheat. And so talking about taking advantage of the tax code in various ways on one side while proposing to rewrite the income tax code of the state provides an avenue for Rauner's people to claim hypocrisy.
Yeah, and it's worth noting here that Rauner himself and Pritzker and a lot of ultra-wealthy people really don't pay income tax like the rest of us do. I think Rauner, the tax returns I've looked at that he's made public, has $0 in sort of the wage income that most of us who trade our labor for cash from our employers get, because they're living off, you know, capital, right? They have investment income. That's a discussion for a different type of show, though, maybe. Let's turn now to House Speaker Michael Madigan. Greg Hines over at Crane's this week had a story about Madigan being confident that he has the votes to remain party chairman. Rick, we heard a lot about people calling for him to step down, both under Governor Rauner's attacks as well as part of the Me Too movement. But are you at all surprised by this? Were you expecting the speaker's position to be challenged or in any way in danger?
I think he himself made it very clear that he did not plan on stepping down from either being House Speaker or Democratic Party Chairman. Yeah, of course, it became an issue with both the Me Too movement as well as a political issue in the Democratic campaign for governor. It also became an avenue of attack from Bruce Rauner because J.B. Pritzker did not specifically say what the fate should be of Michael Madigan. But I think it was pretty clear that Madigan was going to stay as chairman, that there were a couple of insurgent candidates for Democratic State Central Committee, the man and committee woman, and they're the ones who actually cast the vote for chairman. Those insurgent candidates, for the most part, failed, and it was no secret that Madigan was going to, you know, use part of his political operation to make sure that they failed. So, I really... despite the calls and some valid concerns of even some of his own members, I expected that he would remain as Democratic chairman.
You know, Charlie, you've covered the speaker and talked to him for many years. You are one of the few people who have as much tenure in Springfield as the speaker does, really. I mean, you both arrived for ConCon back in so I hope I'm not speaking out of turn here, but
that was true. I first met Michael Madigan when he was a member of the regular Democratic organization of Cook County's delegation to the Constitutional Convention, which first convened in December of 1969.
Right. So you have known him, and you know that one of his overriding goals is maintaining the speakership, electing Democrats to the Illinois House. And I wonder, I've asked him about this, but I wonder, do you think at some point does his political unpopularity become enough of a liability that he considers taking himself out of the equation in order to protect Democrats? I mean, how do you reconcile those two competing impulses?
Well, I don't think there's been any strong evidence yet that this is occurring and that he's diluted his effectiveness. And it's looking back historically on Michael Madigan over the years and some of the things that he's done, it's not power for the sake of power alone. He has no ideological agenda, but it's all about protecting Chicago, the city of Chicago, from, if you will, the barbarians at the gates, people in the suburbs and people downstate. He went to bat for Chicago Public Schools years ago at a time when he told me that most of the people in his ward send their kids to parochial schools, so they don't really care about public schools. He defended Harold Washington, not because he was a bosom buddy of Chicago's first black mayor, but because he did not want powers taken away from the mayor and given to the city council, which was a position being pushed by Ed Vrdoliak, who is the leader of the white ethnics, and his allies here in Springfield. Once upon a time, he sponsored legislation dealing with mega hog farms. And so you say to yourself, what does a kid from 63rd and Keeler care about mega hog farms in western Illinois? He had a candidate running out there, and he was trying to bolster that candidate's chances. So there's a long history of Madigan wanting the job to protect the city protect the legislature as an institution against encroachments from Republican governors who use their mandatory veto in a way that he thought was excessive. And until there's evidence at the voting booth that being a House Democrat supported by Michael Madigan's political operation and the state Democratic machine that he controls, until there's good evidence, I don't think he'd consider stepping down.
I know, and this is despite the fact that a lot of the gubernatorial candidates, Democratic gubernatorial candidates, called for Mike Madigan to step down. I mean, like you said, Charlie, voters seem to be okay as far, but for some Democrats, he's still a liability.
Yeah, and of course, those candidates got in the 20% range, and Pritzker has been much more diplomatic about the speaker, and seems like he's campaigning like a guy who might win and might have to work with Speaker Madigan, and not somebody who just wants to blast him.
Yeah, and that's another thing to note about Madigan's history. He worked well with Republican governors. He was in the legislature for the second half of Governor Richard Ogilvie's term. He was there for Dan Walker, and Walker did not get along with the legislature, Democrats or Republicans. He was there through Jim Thompson. He was there through Jim Edgar. He was there for George Ryan. And he worked well with all of those individuals because they respected him as an individual. They didn't call him a crook, say that he was corrupt, and they didn't come in with an agenda that it was my way or the highway. And I think, as I've said many times on the show, that Governor Rauner's kind of mistake from the get-go was not accepting the fact that he is no longer in a position where he can give orders and other people carry him out. You got to negotiate.
Mm-hmm. I think there's one other factor, too. Let's remember, this is a Democratic-drawn legislative map we're under, too. So, as far as voter support and the fact that those Democratic majorities, don't discount that fact, because I do think if Rauner has had any major success, it has been in vastly weakening the Madigan brand and making him known statewide, which was largely not the case.
Oh, I would also add the historical footnote that from the election of 1992 through the election of 2002, it was a Republican gerrymandered map, and Madigan won 4 out of those 5 elections for a House majority.
This is State Week. Our panelists, Charlie Wheeler, Daisy Contreras, and the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson. I'm Brian Mackey. Daisy, Governor Rauner had a task force that he appointed to look into the Legionnaires' outbreak at the Illinois Veterans Home over in Quincy. They came out with a report this week. What did they say?
Well, they said that the upgrade, if they wanted to upgrade the Quincy Veteran Home, it would cost up to $278 million. It would call for a state-of-the-art residence, new plumbing, and they kind of just broke it down into what each of it would end up costing. And the residential facility, for example, could cost as much as $250 million.
And they're talking about drilling a new well.
New plumbing would be $15.6 million. A well, and even maybe housing, a temporary nursing home for temporary housing would be up to $6.8 million. So it would be very expensive.
Rick, there's been some whispers this week, Rick, about possibly doing a capital bill to help pay for this, because nobody else seems to, think of an easy revenue stream. I don't know. Rick, what do you think? What are the chances of a capital bill? Would you bet on that?
No, I wouldn't. I would say that if anything, though, the fact of this report and the continued problems at Quincy, provide a good avenue for a discussion about a capital bill. But it's an election year. I'm not sure that a big pork bill that the governor could be seen as benefiting from is something that's on the Democrats' agenda. I also don't think that anybody's under an appetite right now in an election year to try to come up with a revenue stream. I mean, that's traditionally when we go out for bonding for capital, we create new streams of revenue, and they often result in some kind of a tax increase. So I would not say I'm very optimistic that we're going to see any kind of big capital bill.
And I would say another problem is that lawmakers don't trust Bruce Rauner because he's lied to them. We went all through the Rod Blagojevich years with no capital bill because Blagojevich lied to lawmakers, lied to other constitutional officers in the first months that he was in office. He lied about what he was going to do with their budgets. And you can't expect a lawmaker to vote for something unpleasant, taxes. And you're right. Every time we've done a capital bill, there's been some revenue stream generated. You say, well, we can borrow money. Yeah, but you got to pay the money off. You got to retire those bonds, and that requires revenue, and we don't have the extra money laying around. And for me as a legislator to agree to increase taxes for a capital program so that you, the governor of the other party, can go out and do these projects, I have to be able to trust you that you will provide something for me in my district. And that's if you remember with Pat Quinn and what did he call it, Illinois Jobs Now or something like that, and video gaming was one of the revenue sources for that. George Ryan came in with Illinois First in his first year in office. That relied on, I believe, increased vehicle license fees and alcohol taxes. But lawmakers were willing to do that because George Ryan, for all of his legal problems, was a man of his word in terms of his dealings with lawmakers. And if they said, if George said to you, yeah, you'll get that road fixed in your district, you could count on it. And I'm afraid that Governor Rauner doesn't have that same level of trust. Look at the fact that Jeannie Ives has still not buried the hatchet, so to speak, other than in his back.
Yeah.
Well, and with Blagojevich, of course, we went through that all of that time of memorandums of understanding lawmakers required him to sign so that he would hold true to his word at any given point. And I think, you know, we could be very close to that stage here in Springfield.
Well, we're going to continue watching what happens in Quincy. I'm sure that's going to continue to be a story. We certainly know it will be because Pritzker has been pushing it on the campaign trail is a line of criticism of Governor Rauner. Let's now turn, since all of us on the panel here spend a lot of time covering both agriculture and international trade, to the tariffs that have been imposed. And I missed a couple of good segues. Charlie, you talked about Speaker Madigan's hog farming bill, and then we were just talking about a pork bill, but now this is a different kind of pork. President Trump has begun this trade war with China, taxing, imposing tariffs on imports of steel and aluminum. China has reacted in part by targeting the heartland in agriculture, soybeans and pork. We're seeing a big effect in Illinois. I mean, I don't know, whoever wants to take this, if anyone does, because, again, it's not necessarily our area of expertise. But do we see Illinois congressmen reacting to this? Do we have any sense of possible widening gulf here between Illinois Republicans who represent a lot of these hog farmers and soybean producers who are going to be, affected by this trade war?
I think when you look at the map of the soybean and pork producing states, and you look at the high agricultural areas, they're also the big red areas in the Midwest. I think it's very clear what China did was a direct targeted attack on Donald Trump's base and of those Republican voters that are there. And I mean, I think there's an interesting play, not only with the Republican congressmen downstate here and how do they react to this, but also with Governor Rauner as well. And, of course, we know Rauner's, I wouldn't say arm's length, it's more like a 20-foot pole kind of length from Donald Trump. But here again, here's another kind of national issue involving the Trump administration, and we all know that the governor is very reluctant to wade into these areas and provide any kind of recommendation on what he thinks. And I think that could also, play a part in his reelection campaign.
Yeah, and it's not a done deal yet. They've announced these tariffs, but there's a certain process that has to be carried through before they can actually be imposed. And were it to come to pass that, in fact, there was a surcharge on the soybeans that China imports, it would affect us in Illinois very dramatically. We're the United States' leading producer of soybeans. China's our best customer. According to an editorial that was in the Sun-Times the other day, the Chinese buy roughly 25% of the soybeans produced in Illinois, worth about $1.75 billion. And so you say to yourself, well, there's maybe only 40,000 farmers affected because most people don't work on farms, most people don't raise hogs. But there's a ripple effect. A hit to the soybean producers will reflect in the community in terms of how many are going to be out buying new agricultural equipment, how many are going to be spending dollars at local stores with local merchants. So you have this impact indirectly that will really, I think, hurt Illinois in a big way. And also, interestingly enough, one of the areas that China has not yet decided to slap a tariff on is major aircraft procurement, which in the case of Illinois means Boeing, which is headquartered here. That's still a card, so to speak, in China's hand that it can play at some point.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. There's so much we didn't get to talk about this week. The legislature is coming back next week. The city of Deerfield has banned assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, leading to a lawsuit involving the NRA. And a bank here in Springfield has pulled out of the medical marijuana business, raising the specter that that's going to be going to an all-cash business here in Illinois. But we're going to have to talk about that another time. It is time now for notes from the field. We've got about 15 seconds each. Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Well, I was very interested to find out that at the Illinois State Fair this year, one of the concert acts is going to be Culture Club with Boy George. I didn't know they still were around.
Back to the 80s at the Illinois State Fair.
Yeah, we're
Fair.
Dating ourselves.
Karma chameleon right now.
That's right. Daisy Contreras.
Yeah, and with the legislature coming back into session this upcoming week, they're going to be tackling issues of net neutrality. So that the protections at national level expire April 23rd, and so individual states are taking it up on themselves to pass legislation that makes sure that each state is protected with net neutrality.
Charlie Wheeler.
Well, Professor Gertz over at the University of Illinois came out with the Flash Index a couple days ago. It showed that our index dipped slightly in March to 104.5, a little bit down from February's 104.6. You can tell I was in print and not broadcast. But anything above 100 means the economy is still growing, albeit at a very slow pace.
Well, I want to take a moment to note that Governor Rauner and his wife, Diana, our First Lady, have had their first grandchild. It's a girl born to his daughter and her husband in California. Not only do we have Grandfather Rauner, but also Godfather Rauner. Apparently, he owned a bunch of papers of Mario Puzo, who wrote The Godfather, donated them to the Rauner Library, not coincidence, at Dartmouth. That's our time for this edition of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Daisy Contreras, and Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. You can get a podcast of this show at nprillinois.org or on the NPR One app. Production assistance for today's program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Brian Mackey.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.